get your bookmarks, be turning your Bibles to the book of Hosea, the 8th chapter. Hosea is the book right after Daniel. It is the first of the minor prophets. I'll talk about that in just a moment. Hosea chapter 8. We have visiting with us this morning Cynthia Turner. Some of you know Cynthia. Linda and I have known her since we were little kids, from grade school on. Cynthia has been a faithful member in West Columbia for many years. Her mom and dad, Ed and Barbara Gray, attended there when we were just little children. Ed passed away 5 years ago. And for a good number of years, Cynthia has been driving right past our building to pick her mom up and take her to West Columbia. But because of health situations, that's no longer something that can be done. And so she wants to place her membership with us and work and worship with us. I'll also tell you, her and her husband and brother own Lakewood Funeral Home in Lake Jackson, where I spend a lot of time. So we have seen each other a lot over the last number of years. And so if you have not met Cynthia, be sure and meet her and welcome her. Our lessons today, including this evening, are going to be focused on a specific period of time, and that is a period of time from 740 to 690 years before Jesus Christ. When you think about the 12 books of history, there is one book that we're going to talk about this evening, and that's going to be the book of 2 Chronicles 26 through 33. These are the chapters involving the four kings that you read about in Isaiah chapter 1. So we have in the five major prophets the book of Isaiah, and down here in the 12 minor prophets, the one that is chronological to this is the book of Hosea. So Hosea has, if you look at it, is the same four kings. You see them in the book of Micah. Hosea was prophesying to the northern kingdom, the kingdom to the south. Isaiah was prophesying to this nation went away in 721. How the book of Hosea is different from Isaiah in two ways, very clearly. Number one, this nation was already gone. They were a corpse. They had not yet been put in the grave, but they were gone. Isaiah, we're looking at a time 150 years before this. The amazing thing about the book of Hosea is God demanded that Hosea live the prophecy that he was going to tell the people. And what I want to talk about this morning is it is one of the most unique books that you will ever come across. And as we get into it, you'll understand what I'm talking about. He wanted Hosea to feel in his gut exactly what God was feeling. He wanted Hosea to go through the same emotions that he was going through. So when he put into writing, reduced to writing, the prophecy, his heart and soul and his emotions were in it because he was living the prophecy in and of himself. When you think about the book of Hosea, the word wind occurs several times throughout the book. Very much like we've talked about in the book of Ecclesiastes, trying to grab the wind or striving after the wind. The wind is an emotion or a feeling, something powerful taking over a nation. And that's oftentimes the way it's manifested. We have songs, that old songs talking about the winds of change. Would you agree with me that we have winds of change blowing in this nation? Well, they did too. So in Hosea chapter 8 and verse 7, he says, "They sow the wind," Hosea told them, "and they reap the whirlwind." They had sown the wind. They had the change that was coming was exactly what you saw to their neighbors to the south. And that is, if you were to think about the nation of Canada as an example, or Mexico and America. Well, we're different countries, but we border one another and we know each other. We have relationships back and forth. The northern and southern kingdoms were the same way. They knew each other. They were kinfolk from many years back. But one of them, because of when Rehoboam and Jeroboam became the kings of the united nation that split and it became divided, Jeroboam brought into place a religion of convenience. He didn't want the people to go to Jerusalem, but he said, "I'm building a temple in Dan and one in Bethel with a golden calf because I don't want you to have to travel so far." So the whole thing, religious-wise, was built on a religion of convenience. And because of that, every single king that the northern kingdom had was an ungodly, wicked king. That's why this nation that would actually finally be destroyed in 586 B.C. Now let me tell you just a little quip to think about this. The nation that destroyed the nation of Israel was the nation of Assyria. Do you know that 100 years or so, 120 years before this, God sent a prophet by the name of Jonah. And Jonah went to Nineveh. Nineveh was the capital city of Assyria. And he said to them, 40 days and this nation will be destroyed if you don't repent. And every person in that nation repented, from the king down to the animals in sackcloth and ashes. So you see this same nation now, 100 years later, coming in to take over and rule and reap the bounty from God's people that had fallen. Now, in looking at chapter 12 in verse 1, you see the second time you have this idea of wind. Ephraim was a name that God used and that Hosea used talking about Israel. They were the same. Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east winds continually. You remember, those of you in the class this morning, we were talking about Isaiah said that you were filled with beliefs from the east, and that would be from Assyria and Babylon, all types of false religion that had come in, and that was the same thing that happened to this nation. Going back with me to Hosea chapter 1, I want you to think about this with me for just a moment. The book of Hosea is interesting in this regard. It is a blunt book, but God says to his people, I'm disciplining you. I will eventually punish you, not because I hate you, and not because I don't care about you, but because I love you. And the ones that make it through, I will take care of in a way they've never been taken care of before. In the book of Hosea chapter 1 and verse 2, when the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take for yourselves a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land has committed flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, name him Jezreel, the first child born to them. For yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu. Now he was a very wicked king, and he lived in the city of Jezreel. And he says, I will punish the house of Jezreel, verse 4, for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel and the valley of Jezreel. Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, which means unloved. A child that's not loved. I'm going to tell you a while in a minute. For I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I should forever forgive them. In verse 9, and the Lord said, name him. They had verse 8. She had weaned Lo-Ruhamah. She conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami. For you are not my people. And the word Lo-Ami means not mine. In chapters 2 and 3 and 4, what you see is this. Gomer was not a prostitute. In fact, the King James Version says she was a woman of her age. She was just a woman of the times where sexuality was just free and flowing and everybody did what they wanted to do and there were no restraints whatsoever. And so he took Gomer and he had a child with her and the child was named Jezreel. And then after that, she left him and she ran off. And she was gone for some period of time and he couldn't find her and eventually found her. And when he brought her back, he found her, she was with child. And he didn't know if it was his child or it wasn't his child. But he brought her back. In the second chapter, what you see in verse 6, chapter 2 and verse 6, he's thinking about, you can see in verse 3 what he was thinking about doing, how he was going to treat her. But in verse 6, therefore behold, I will hedge her up with thorns, and I'll build a wall against her so she cannot find her path. And she will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. And she will seek them, but will not find them. Then she will say, I'll go back to my first husband, for it was better for me than now. And that's what he was hoping. Then a little bit further in verse 14, he says, therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her, and I will give her vineyards from there. Then, as he brought her back and he was doing everything he knew how to do to try to make her happy and to try to make her content and feel comfortable and feel like this was her home, she left again. She left again. And it took him a good long time to find his wife, and when he found her, she had another child, and he knew it was not his child. So when you look in chapter 1, what you see is, you see the three children, Jezreel, which was meant to say the city where Jehu the wicked king lived, I'm going to destroy it, and you're going to remember the destruction of that by the name of your child. The second child, he wasn't sure if it was his child or not, and so he did not have the feelings that maybe he would have if he knew for a fact it was his, because he didn't know. The third child, so Lo Ruhamah and Lo Ami, which means not mine, the third child. He knew the child had already been born. Now, throughout the second and third chapter, you will see over and over and over how the things that Hosea tried to do to make this young woman happy. He took care of her. He built her a house. He gave her everything she wanted, but she wanted to go after other men in some way that he couldn't understand. What's amazing about this text, very simply, is this. They have the three children. She commits harlotry. She is the representation of the nation of Israel. And you can see it throughout the whole text. Look in chapter 1 again. Chapter 1 and verse 4. The Lord said, name him, him Jezreel. In a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. Verse 7. I'll have compassion on the house of Judah. That's the southern kingdom. That's the kingdom that Isaiah was prophesying to for some period of time, because they were not as ungodly. But throughout all of this, when you take a look at chapter 3 and verse 1, you're going to see that Hosea is a representation of God, and the nation of Israel is a representation of this woman of the age that was always going after other things, not happy with her husband, God. In chapter 3 and verse 1, you can see the Lord said, come again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, and though they turn to other gods and love raisin canes, and I brought her for myself. And he talks about how he redeemed this nation. So what I would say to you is this. Unlike any other book that you read, God forced this man to live the prophecy that he was giving. He wanted him to feel it in his belly. Not just up here in his brain, but to feel it in his gut. What does it feel like when you do everything you can to try to make someone happy, and yet they constantly leave you and they're chasing after other men over and over and over again? And Hosea, you will see this in the text, becomes very bitter because he couldn't make this woman happy and she wouldn't stay home. And God said, that's exactly how I feel about this nation, that I brought them up from the loins of Abraham all the way through the ordeal in Egypt, 400 years through the wilderness. I took care of them. I made water come out of rocks. I turned bread into stone into bread, rather. But it wasn't enough. It was never enough. So what you see in this text very simply is this. In Hosea chapter 4, it will be similar in some ways to what we started studying in class, if you were in the adult class. But in chapter 4, listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel, for the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land because there is unfaithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. Do you feel like in the country that you live? I saw a quote some years ago in a book by Abraham Lincoln, and he wrote this as a preamble to the Gettysburg Address. He says, I feel that I am living in a country to which I was not born. What's amazing, if you study that, there had been a battle called the Battle of Entebbe 2 days before. 55,000 people were killed. And you can go, if you go to the library in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, you will see hundreds and hundreds of men stacked up with a stake. Here's Texas, 1,000 men over here. Here's Missouri, 750 men. And they dug massive graves and just put these people, men, in the graves. It was so, there were so many, all the roads were filled, so they had to take Abraham Lincoln out of his presidential carriage and bring him in by horseback. And he was running for president. This was going to be a campaign speech. He sat down that night and he wrote what is now called the Gettysburg Address, and he gave it the next day. Now, he didn't feel like that was the country he lived in. He'd never seen anything like that. Do you feel that way? Well, the Lord said that's how he saw Israel. There's no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing and deception and murder and stealing and adultery. Verse 2, they employ violence, so bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore, the land mourns. The land mourns. The physical land that God takes care of. God will sometimes force people off the land and he'll purify the land, but God takes care of the land. And everyone who lives in it languishes, verse 3, along with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky, and also the fish of the sea disappear. Yet no one finds fault, and let no one offer reproof. The idea means to prove again. Go back and remember what it was that you knew before, and rethink that and relearn it. So all of this is happening, and nobody thinks a thing about it. Why? Because there's no knowledge of God in the land. There's not any restrictive force like there was in previous times with this nation. There's nothing to stop it. So he says in verse 4, no one finds fault. I would say to you today, if you were to walk up and down the streets and just ask people, how do you think things are going in this country? How do you think things are going? Most people would say, well, you know, we ought to have more jobs. And we ought to have a minimum wage of $15. And they're focused on this life, things of this life. How much of the world around us even sees what's happening to our country? Now look a little bit further as we look in the text. In verse 4, for your people are those who contend with priests, so you'll stumble by day, and the prophets will stumble with you by night, and I will destroy your mother. My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will reject you from being my priest. The priests were the problem, or a good portion. They didn't know God's word. They weren't standing in the gap to try to mitigate the problems. I also reject you from being priests, since you have forgotten the law of God. I will also forget your children. The more they multiplied, the more they sinned against me. I will change their glory into shame. They feed on the sins of my people. In verse 11, harlotry and wine and new wine take away the understanding. Stop for just a moment. I did a lesson 2 weeks ago that I called the father factor. And I talked about how many people that I talk with that are in the business, and I'm talking about in the business of trying to help fix this problem. And I said to you that alcohol has been around since the time of Noah. Drugs, things that would change a person's mind and make them feel different, have been around since the beginning of time. That's not the problem. Well, here he says, even going back, if you would take a look at this, is 2,700 years ago. One of the problems that this nation had was, in verse 11, harlotry and wine and new wine take away the understanding. My people consult wooden idols, and their diviners one inform them. You know, when I was a kid, we had a thing called Rubik's Cube. Anybody ever remember that? And we had a board. My father wouldn't let us play Ouija. Anybody know what that is, a Ouija board? My father thought that somehow the devil was in it. There was no Ouija board in my house. But consulting all these things to try to get the answers to life, how crazy is that? The latter part of verse 12, for a spirit of harlotry has led them away. They were like Gomer. They kept going after other things other than God. And God eventually had a belly full of it. In verse 13, they offer sacrifices on the tops of mountains and burn incense on the hills under oaks and poplar and terebinth. Because their shade is pleasant, therefore you daughters play the harlot. Your daughters play the harlot and your brides commit adultery. There was no sense of understanding the marriage relationship, the family relationship. Does that sound common to you? Do you see that today? Verse 14, I will not punish your daughters when they play the harlot, or your brides when they commit adultery, for the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with temple prostitutes, so the people without understanding are ruined. Look in verse 16. Since Israel is stubborn, like a stubborn heifer, can the Lord now pasture them like a lamb in a large field? If Ephraim is joined to idols, let him alone. Their liquor gone, they play the harlot continually. Their rulers deal dearly love shame. The wind wraps them in its wings, and they will be ashamed because of the sacrifice. Again, the wind talking here about the culture, the change that was sweeping over this nation. I want you to look at something that he talks about here. This is just kind of a quick overview of what we just read. There was no faithfulness in the land. There was no faithfulness to God. There was no faithfulness to family, to children, to anything. There was no knowledge found in them. And so nobody saw anything wrong with it. It's just something that happened. You know, it's an amazing thing. Many years ago, Brother Larry Bilbo used an example, and this example was so powerful that it stuck in my brain maybe 40 years later. He was talking about, you're going to build a 100-foot wall over here, and you get an 8-foot stud, and you take that 8-foot stud and you put it over here, and you use that stud to cut the next stud. You don't measure the second one and the third one and the fourth one. You just use that one. And he said, if you cut on the wrong side of the line every single time, that stud is a little bit shorter. Now, some of you here have seen things that I've built in my life, and if it was an eighth inch off, I'd say nail it. Here's the problem. If you've got an 8-foot board here, and you're off a little bit, and you go 100 boards, now you've got a 7-foot board, or a 6.5-foot board. That's exactly what happens when you measure how things are supposed to be based on the last event or the last decision, or based on, well, this is the way my parents did it, or this is the way whatever. And so we're cutting on the wrong side of the board. So now over a 10 or 15 year period of time, you stand back, and even I can look at this and say, man, that board's not 8 feet down there. But when you see a little bit at a time, you don't realize that. Where there was security and happiness, they didn't understand where it came from. I want you to think about, for about 25 years, Linda and I lived out in the country. And we took a little 3 acres of land, and we were going to make a yard out of it. Well, we didn't make the yard anything. The yard made us something. Because what I realized was, we are trying to reclaim wilderness here. We would plant grass, and we would fertilize the grass, and we'd do all kinds of things. And about next March, April, stuff would come up everywhere. I mowed my yard many, many times, and come out the next day, and there are weeds a foot tall. I used to tell Linda, you ought to be able to hear that growing. Just stand out on the porch. If something grew a foot in 24 hours, but what you realize is it's easy to sow junk. There's junk everywhere, junk grass everywhere. When you think about, the same thing is true with spiritual destitution. It's easy to sow junk in your life. It's so easy. It's like a dead fish swimming downstream. It's very easy to do. And Matthew chapter 7 says, not everyone that calls on me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons and do many great works? And he said to them in verse 23, I don't know who you are because you sow junk. You did not give me back what I wanted. And Psalm chapter 1 talks about the man who stands and then sits at the feet of scoffers and amongst sinners. And he says about that man, his life will be ruined because he's a fool. Being ungodly, it's so easy. It's a cakewalk. Anybody can be ungodly. And it doesn't take hardly any effort whatsoever. I would say to you, it doesn't take discipline. It doesn't take self-control. It doesn't take thinking. If all you have to do is just kind of amble through life, and you can turn out to be a perfectly healthy, ungodly person. Because it doesn't take any effort at all. I want you to think about You don't have to work at it. You know, we have services on Sunday morning, and you're here, and we're going to have them again tonight, and we're going to try to encourage you to come tonight, and we're going to have class on Wednesday night, and we're going to have you come do that. And I get involved in a pretty good number of personal studies. And when somebody's not here for a few weeks, we'll send some texts and calls out, hey, where you at? We're missing you. What's going on? Can we help you? But do you know, if you didn't go to church, nobody would bother you. Nobody would care where you're at or what you're doing. And so it's just so incredibly easy. You don't have to work at it at all. You don't have to work to learn gratitude. Brother Ashley started his talk a little while ago about how thankful he was for being here today and how thankful he was for the country that we live in and the prosperity. Do you know, it takes no effort. If you don't want to learn gratitude, to have a heart of gratitude, it's easy as falling off a log, to use an old saying. No effort whatsoever. What about respect for authority? I've said to you, if a child does not learn how to respect their parents properly, they're not going to respect the kindergarten or first grade teacher. They're not going to respect the principal. They're not going to respect the chief of police. And oh, by the way, there's not a chance on this earth they will ever respect God. In God's word. It's not possible. It isn't in them. But what I would say, the reverse of that is, it takes no effort if you don't want to learn respect in your mind. What about responsibility? Responsibility for choices that you have made. If you did something that was wrong, owning up to it. Do you see that? We had a conversation this morning about our elected officials. How elected officials are doing things for themselves. When was the last time that you saw any elected official claim responsibility for a mistake they made? Does that happen? Even right down to the lower, the leadership of Brazoria. Let me just tell you, I get invited to say a prayer before the city council meeting. And here back a year or two ago when you guys were trying to put in this water park out here, 60, 70, 80 people crammed into about a 30 by 30 building. I'm saying a prayer, Lord, let everybody behave themselves and pay attention. You know, be respectful. I leave and... But that doesn't require any effort. If you have no discipline and you don't discipline your children, that is the easiest thing to do in the world. But that's why in Hebrews chapter 12, he says, if there are children that nobody disciplines them, they're illegitimate, meaning nobody cares how they end up. Now, what I would tell you very simply is this. You do what you want to do all of your life. Nobody tells you what to do, and it's the easiest thing in the world. But if you sow the wind, you're going to reap the whirlwind. That is a principle that goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. Whatever seed you put in the ground, that's the seed that's going to grow up. I told a story some time ago. I was working out at Plan A Dow Chemical, and there was which is right on the beach. And there was a hurricane that just came up like 80, 90 miles off the beach. And about 3-4 days later came roaring in 75, 80 miles an hour winds. And people didn't have a chance to track it. Now, I had this guy who worked with me that was highly educated, but as close to being an idiot as I've ever known in my life. Now, he loved collecting seashells. So he figured out, if there's a hurricane out there, it's going to suck the water out. This is where the storm tide comes in. So he went out there the day before the hurricane and found seashells. And he was telling everybody, oh, I was a half a mile away from where the water normally is. At least he had enough sense to get out of there before the water came back. Because when it came back, it was all the way to Angleton. Now, that's what happens when people say, I'm going to live the way I want to live. I want to do what I want to do. I'm going to be the boss of me. Okay? But as Hosea tells you, you sow the wind, And you'll reap the whirlwind. It will come up. There may be a time lag, and maybe you have a hard time putting together, I made this decision, and this happened later because there was a time lag in between, very much like the water that I'm talking about. But I would say to you, that's what this book is all about. That's what they did for the 100 years or so beforehand. They did everything they wanted to do in life. In Ephesians chapter 4, he talks about that everything. He talks about a person who at one time knew, but then they became ignorant. And people that had calloused hearts, their consciences became calloused. And he says that's where all sin comes from. 1 Peter chapter 4. Let's turn there for just a moment. In 1 Peter chapter 4, he talks about partying with people. And then you decide you want to get your life right. And you would think that people around you, your old buddies, would want to be happy that you wanted to get your life right. And Peter says, doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. In 1 Peter chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. 1 Peter 4 and 1, therefore Christ has suffered in the flesh, so arm yourselves with the same purpose, because he who suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. For the time is already past, is sufficient for you to have carried out the desires of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, of lust, of drunkenness, carousals, drinking parties, abominable idolatries. These are various types of consumption of alcohol, from what we would call social drinking to party drinking to maybe being an alcoholic. Abominable atrocities in verse 4. And in the same way, they are surprised. The people that were your old friends are surprised that you do not run with them to the same excess of dissipation, and they are so happy about it. Is that what your Bible says? They malign you. They trash mouth you, because who do you think you are? You're supposed to go with us. None of us do anything right, and you're supposed to go with us. In verse 5, but they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. When you take a look at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, where he talked about young men, young people, enjoy, pursue the thoughts and dreams of your heart. Do what you want to do. This is the time of your life where you don't have a lot of responsibilities. But he finishes in verse 10 by saying, yet know that God will hold you account for every decision that you make, whether it be good or evil. Chapter 20 and 12 and verse 20 is the story you remember of the man that says, I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger barns. And I'll say to myself, eat, drink, and be merry. Now that was an old saying. And the last half of that saying that the man that Luke didn't quote was, for tomorrow you die. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. You'll see that in the book of Ezekiel when we study it. And the Lord said, you fool. That's what verse 20 says. You fool. This very night, your soul will be required of you. You see, you missed it by a day. You thought you had tomorrow. Now, in looking at this, what I would say is this. The world says anything the majority of the people believe is right. Right? Isn't that the world that we live in? When you begin seeing the winds of change come and the nation sees things differently, whatever the country believes is right. There's an interesting thing, Exodus chapter 21 and verse 2. It's two verses after Moses gives the Ten Commandments. And Exodus 21 and verse 2 says, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Isn't that interesting? That God told Moses to put that right after the Ten Commandments? When I was a kid, we would all, I'm sure it's the same, but Mom, but Dad, everybody's doing it. And my sweet mother would say, if everybody jumped in the river, would you do it? Yes. Off a bridge. I did it many, many, many times. Black's Ferry Bridge. Live to tell the story. But if the majority does it, it's okay. If Hollywood decides and people on TV decide that things are not right and so we need to make changes, and they start cramming down your throat certain ideas and concepts, the wind that Hosea is talking about is coming. It's changing. You begin seeing people. I remember thinking about this as I got a little bit older, how we idolize so many people on TV. Oh, we wish we were like them. We wish they were like them. And then all of a sudden the magazine started coming out, and you realize what a horrible life they had. But they didn't look like it when they were on TV, did they? Well, if we take a look at what the world's doing, and we do a little bit better, just a little bit better, then we'll be fine. I guess if God judged people on the curve, then that'd be okay, but He doesn't. He judges us by the same standard as He did people 2,000 or 3,000 and 4,000 years ago. Multiple times, Proverbs 14 and 12, Proverbs 12 and 15, and 16 and 25, He says the same thing. And that is, there is a way that seems right to a man, the end result of which is destruction. When we finish the last verse in chapter 2 of Isaiah, Isaiah said, "Why do you trust men whose breath is in their body?" That's foolishness. Now look at this a little bit further. You remember 1 Samuel chapter 8, we studied a while back, when they were tired of Eli's boys didn't turn out right. Samuel's boys didn't turn out right. They were worthless. And so the people said, "We want a king like all the nations round about us. We want to be like everybody else." And God said, "Do you really?" "Yes." "Here it comes. You ready, boys and girls? It's coming. I'll give you a king." And they got one. They got a lot of them. In Hosea chapter 2 and verse 13, "I will punish her before the days of Baal." That was one of the gods that they worshipped. Do you know Baal worship is very, very similar to what we today call the Green Movement or the tree huggers, where you worship nature, you worship the world. One of the great worries that we have about in this country today is global warming. Global warming. Because in the last 100 years, we may have increased in temperature, may have 0.1%. Here's a newsflash. Global warming is coming to this world. If you want to understand global warming, read 2 Peter 3. Where this entire ball that we live on is going to be one large flame. That, brothers and sisters, is global warming. But he says in verse 13, "I will punish her in the days of Baal, when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with earrings and jewelry and follow her lovers, so she forgot me, declares the Lord." That's exactly what he wanted Hosea to understand. I want you to feel it in your gut, Hosea, what I'm feeling. Psalm chapter 10, if you look at that just for a moment, he talks about, let's just turn there for a second, Psalm chapter 10. In Psalm chapter 10, beginning in verse 3, it's a powerful passage. Psalm 10 and 3, talking about when people become prosperous, they become proud and arrogant. Psalm 10 and 3, "For the wicked boasts in his heart's desire, and the greedy man curses and spurns the Lord. The wicked in the haughtiness of his countenance does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there's no God." So if the prevailing wisdom of the United States of America is there's no God, or God doesn't care what we do, then the whole country goes that way. And unless you understand God, like we talked about in the book of Isaiah, there's nobody there to say, "This ain't right. This is not right. You're not supposed to be doing this." In verse 5, "His ways are prosperous all the time." These are people looking at somebody that's done well in this world. "Thy judgments on high are out of his sight." God can't touch him or her. As for all his adversaries, he snorts at them. He says to himself, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not be in adversity. Verse 7, his mouth is full of curses and deceits and oppression. He sits under, and his tongue is mischief and wickedness. He sits under the lurking places of the village, in the hiding places. He kills the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the unfortunate. He lurks in hiding places as a lion in a lair. He lurks to catch the afflicted. He catches the afflicted when he draws him into his net. He crashes his bow. He bows down, and the unfortunate fall by his mighty ones. He says to himself, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. Now, that's what the prevailing wisdom of any world is. And I don't care how good it is now, it'll change. The winds of change will come. And that's what Hosea is talking about. And so people will sow the wind. You will sow to the culture of your day. And when it comes back on you, it's not going to be a nice breeze. It'll be a whirlwind. Now looking at this, very quickly, our time is about up. Can you think of any young person, young girl, that when she's a small child, she says, I'd like to be a prostitute when I grow up? Nobody does that. I've talked with more people, not as much as a few of you in this building, but who are alcoholics. And I've heard this over and over and over again. I ask them, did you plan to be an alcoholic or a druggie? No. You just failed to plan. There was no plan. So what you see happen here is nobody plans that. It's actually the lack of planning. So from time to time, all of us are like that. When we go after other things, and these other things take us away from a knowledge of God and an understanding of God and a relationship with God, at some point in time, God says, I'm turning my back on you. We oftentimes will talk about God destroying nations. This is what you're going to see in the book of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. God doesn't actually destroy nations. He just turned his back. He withholds his salvation, his help, and his comfort. And nations just destroy themselves. Look around you. So, when a child of God has made a vow to God, there was a time in your life, every single one of you that are children of God, that you made the decision that I want to be baptized for the remission of my sins. And God promised you, I'll take away every terrible, disgusting thing you ever did. You might have forgotten this 30 years ago, but I haven't forgotten it. But when you're baptized into Christ, I'm wiping it all out. You're starting a brand new baby in Christ. God expects things from us. He expects us to grow and learn and not stay babies. So all of a sudden, we turn our back on God for a period of time because I've got something else that's more important to me. And then the time comes that God says, oh, okay, so you don't need me anymore. That's what you're telling me? Rick, that's what you're telling me? You don't need me anymore? Okay, I'll just forget about you. I'll just write you off. And then he leaves us to our own devices. How does that work? We forsake our vows to God and go after others, lovers, and money. We forget where our blessings and security will come from and our lives, throughout our lives and all throughout eternity. You forget who, I did a lesson a while back, maybe a year ago, who's your daddy? Who's your daddy? That's a phrase I hear all the time. Well, who's your daddy? Who's your daddy? Who's taking care of you? I just use that in a lesson. If you forget who your daddy is, then you will sow the wind and you will reap the whirlwind. And I'm telling you, I don't care who your parents are, your grandparents, brothers and sisters in Christ, you built a house. And you're going to live in that house. You come back to God. God says, I'll make certain that you will never have more than you can handle. I will promise you, you come back to me. I don't care how many mistakes you've made in your life. You come back to me. I will make certain that there's a way of escape and that nothing ever happens to you that you can't handle. And brothers and sisters, we can make the most horrible mistakes a human being can make. And those mistakes can be turned into wonderful, godly things that will make us stronger and better. Read the book of Job. Job started out being a godly man. He was so much closer to God at the end of his life than he was before this happened. God took all kinds of tragic things and made them be wonderful, great things. Hosea chapter 10. I want to look at that and our time is up. Hosea chapter 10. Just for a moment. This is quite an impressive book, because throughout the book, God says to Hosea over and over and over again, you know how I'm feeling, Hosea. You know exactly what's going on in my mind, Hosea, because it's going on in your mind too. In Hosea chapter 10 and verse 13 beginning, you plowed wilderness. This is Hosea 10:13. You plowed wickedness. You have reaped injustice. You have eaten the fruit of lies. Because you have trusted in your ways, in your numerous warriors, therefore a tumult will arise among your people, and all your fortresses will be destroyed, and Shalman destroyed. And he's talking about great strong men and nations. The latter part of verse, when mothers were dashed to pieces with their children, thus it will be done to you at Bethel because of your great wickedness, and the dawn of the king of Israel will be completely cut off. That's what happened to this nation. And I'm going to just close with this. How is Hosea, who the same four kings, we're going to study their stories tonight. There are four very interesting stories about these four kings. And when you see who the kings were and their lives, it's going to make more sense to you as you study this. Hosea was prophesying and alive when this nation went down. You see here 740 to 690. Isaiah lived a long time before, but God placed it in his mind exactly what it was going to look like. Hosea was prophesying to a nation, and he was saying, there will be a small remnant of you left. I, Hosea, would like for that remnant to be as big as possible, but the nation is going under. Does it give you comfort today that if you're a child of God, you got his name stamped on your forehead, and he knows who you are by name? The New Testament, Jesus tells us there's not a bird that falls from the sky that God doesn't know who it is. Do you think he doesn't know who his children are? So I would tell you, I hope and I pray that this nation lasts a while longer, a good while longer. I'd love to see my grandchild and maybe great-grandchildren grow up with the prosperity and the freedoms that we have here. And so I'm doing what I can to try to help slow the process down. But if it's too late and the Lord takes this nation and we're all speaking Arabic or Chinese, I'm proud that he knows my name. You just make sure he knows yours. We got a song selected that we're going to sing this morning. That will be our song of encouragement for the day. For anyone here that needs to be baptized into Christ or needs to make any type of acknowledgement. Number 348, one of my very favorite invitation songs. Please stand if you need to respond, let it be known.